this important lecture and the launch of this important book. There's a number of past presidents I should acknowledge. I'm not actually sure what a collective noun for a group of past presidents is. I spoke at a conference once of school principals where somebody pointed out that the appropriate collective is LAC. I'll give you time to catch up with that one. But the Academy has named this lecture after Keith Hancock, and it's a particular pleasure that he's with us as one of the past presidents. The others are Professor Sue Richardson, Professor Joe Isaac, and Professor Leon Mann, all of whom are sitting over in this part of the room. So I'd like to welcome them along with all of you. And to say something just a little more about Keith, after whom we've chosen to name this lecture. He was a lecturer in economics in Adelaide from 59 to 63 and was appointed Foundation Professor of Economics in the Bedford Park campus of the University of Adelaide, which 2 years later became the Flinders University of South Australia, where he served as Professor of Economics and then and where he established what was at the time called the Flinders University Institute of Labour Studies, which later became the National Institute of Labour Studies. He became Vice Chancellor of that university as well for a considerable period. Became Vice Chancellor in 1966. No, that's when it became the university. He followed. He chaired a number of important government inquiries to the racing industry in South Australia, the Superannuation Committee of Inquiry, and the Review of Industrial Relations Law and Systems in Australia. And he served on a number of other inquiries, one on unemployment statistics and one on the Australian financial system. He left the university world in 1987 to become a deputy president of the Australian Conciliation and Arbitration Commission, a body which changed its name and to some extent its role a couple of times. During his period there, he remained as a deputy president and became a senior deputy president and retired from that position in 1997. He was appointed an officer in the Order of Australia in 1987. He became a fellow of this academy in 1968 and served as its president from 1981 to 1984. So a long and substantial connection with the academy, as well as with academic and more general life in this country. So it's, I think, very important for us as an academy that we've been able to honour Keith by naming this lecture after him, or for him. I also, by introducing him, have made it clear that it's a lecture named for someone living who's with us. At some point it may change that status, Keith, but not yet. And we hope you'll come annually to prove it hasn't yet changed. But I'd like now to call on Professor John Dewar, who's Provost of the University and also at the moment acting Vice Chancellor, to introduce the Minister. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Barry. And it is indeed a great pleasure to welcome all of you to the University of Melbourne for this very important occasion. And I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet this evening, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. I'd also like to join Barry in acknowledging Professor Hancock. To you, Keith, and indeed to acknowledge all the members of the Academy of Social Sciences who are with us here this evening. My role in tonight's proceedings is short and I hope sweet. It's to introduce our very important guest who's here to launch the book by Stuart McIntyre. That guest, of course, is the Minister for Innovation, Industry, Science and Research, Senator Kim Carr. It was only 3 weeks ago that the Minister was here on campus for another important occasion, which was the launch of the Australian Collaboration for Accelerator Science, an initiative which involves sciences other than the social ones. I must say I was very impressed when, during his speech on that occasion, the Minister threw in an appreciative reference to Stuart McIntyre's The Poor Relation, even to that audience heavy with nuclear scientists, physicists and engineers. Clearly, Stuart's is a book that the Minister values highly. Tonight, as on that and earlier occasions, it's a real pleasure to be able to share this launch and the stage with Minister Carr. Senator Kim Carr, of course, needs little introduction, especially at his alma mater, the University of Melbourne, where he's very much part of the family. He's a three-time graduate of ours, and his service in public office since 1993 is perhaps the best known part of his CV. But before entering Parliament in that year, he'd also worked as a teacher and as a ministerial advisor. Since entering Parliament, Senator Carr has shown a committed interest in the research portfolio, serving as shadow minister in the science and research portfolio from 2001 to 2004, and again in 2006 to 2007 while on the opposition benches. And since the election of the Commonwealth Labour government in November 2007, he's been a member of Cabinet serving as Minister for Innovation, Industry, Science and Research. In that capacity, he has been a strong supporter of growth in Australia's research infrastructure, and most importantly for tonight's purposes, not only infrastructure for research in the physical sciences, but in the social sciences and to support cross-disciplinary research as well. So tonight then, Minister Carr comes to us as someone uniquely qualified to speak with a real appreciation for the long story of policy history relating to research that is revealed by Stuart's book. And like you, I'm eager to hear what he has to say. So please join me in welcoming the Minister for Innovation, Industry, Science and Research, Senator Kim Carr.
Acting Vice Chancellor, thank you very much for those kind remarks, and to Professor Barry Hill and all the other distinguished former presidents of the Academy of the Social Sciences, to Stuart McIntyre, the Ernest Scott Professor of History, Professor Keith Hancock, particular acknowledgement, Miss Louise Adler, who's done an enormous contribution to intellectual life in this country. I acknowledge you especially as well. Look, tonight is a great honour for me to be launching a new book by Professor Stuart McIntyre. And that's not just because it says kind things about the substantial increase, that's the word you use, the substantial increase Labor has made to funding for research in universities over the past 2.5 years. It's an honour for me because Stuart and I go back a long way, so I should declare this matter. Stuart was probably one of my most important history teachers. I think I've read just about all his history books, maybe not all his articles, but I value him enormously as a source of wise counsel and as a friend. Now, having made all of those admissions, I better find something critical to say about the poor relations, or people will question my objectivity. And that's just simply not easy. It's not easy at all, because this is a very fine book. It traces the development of the social sciences, and especially the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia, against a background of continuous institutional and social change. It does so essentially from the Second World War to the present. If I have one quibble, it is that Stuart takes a rather downtrodden view of these disciplines, hence the book's title. That's not a view I share. And since I've started in this job, and as Stuart observes, and I quote him here, I've been particularly anxious to involve the humanities and social sciences in the great project of renewal and modernisation that is central to my portfolio. There's just no denying that the social sciences, alongside the humanities and the creative arts, were marginalised over the decade of the previous government. It's no accident that all 9 of the projects notoriously denied Australian Research Council funding by Brendan Nelson, one of them twice, were in these fields. Most of them touched on some aspect of Asia or sexuality. And so if you wanted to research sexuality in Asia under the previous government, you may as well have forgotten it. Stuart provides an account of this sorry episode in this book. Now, we set out to change that. And we've done that from day one. of our election. We opened the International Science Linkage Scheme and the Cooperative Research Centres program to the humanities, arts and social sciences. We put a HASS representative on the Prime Minister's Science, Engineering and Innovation Council. We've seen a HASS discipline secured a much better share of the total funding of the Australian Research Council. It's risen from some 22% of total funding a few years ago to some 30% in 2010. We nominated history, English, sociology, education and economics as priority disciplines for the Future Fellowship Scheme in 2010, along with Asian studies as a priority research area. And of course, for that, I make no apology to Brendan Nelson. We've done a great deal in 2.5 years to restore the standing, not just of the social sciences, the arts and the humanities, but of the university sector as a whole. And as Stuart points out in his Poor Relations, and I quote, Australia was the only OECD country in which the public contribution to higher education remained at the same levels in 2005 as it was in 1995. Stuart also makes the point that even after adjustments for industry structure, business was investing less than half as much in research as the world leaders. We're well below the OECD average in this measure. Now, Labor's task from 2007 has been, and again, as Stuart puts it, quote, to peg out new directions. We started from the premise that you can't have an internationally competitive economy without a strong innovation system. And you can't have a strong innovation system without great universities and great researchers. Australia's capacity to do original, quality research is critical to our future well-being. It is true, we place enormous demands on our researchers. I make no apology for this either. But it's amazing what we do ask of people. We ask our researchers to give us the solutions that will cure the sick, feed the hungry, and save the planet. We expect them to fuel new industries and improve our quality of life. We expect them to interpret the world and to help us change it. And that's why Labor has increased spending on research and innovation by 34% since 2007. And that's why in 2.5 short years, we've injected billions of dollars into the university system for infrastructure, for teaching, for learning, and for research. And that funding continues to grow. Our improvements to the indexation of block grants will deliver an extra $2.6 billion to universities from 2011 through to 2015. Not that you'd hear a word of this in any of the Murdoch newspapers. The Sustainable Research Excellence in Universities, our new scheme to support the indirect research costs, will deliver another $1.1 billion or so over the same period. So you'll forgive me when I get down to the nitty-gritty on these matters, and I know Stuart will forgive me for this. This is a measure, and all of these measures, are what's at stake on the 21st of August. When our opponents came to office in 1996, they cut higher education outlays by $1.8 billion. That's in their first 4 years. In 2010, they don't have a policy on innovation or research. All we know is that they expect people to essentially, as Joe Hockey says, he says, we want to find incentives for people to invest in themselves. What we also know is from my direct, the shadow minister, they're refusing to rule out cuts to the Australian Research Council or the NHMRC. So this is why I say to you, all that we've achieved is at risk, including the recognition of the social sciences that Stewart argues so compelling for in this whole book. The social sciences will be, of course, never a poor relation while I'm on my watch. They are incredibly important to our prosperity, to our quality of life, and to our understandings of ourselves. Thank you, Stuart.
Well, thank you very much to Professor Dewar for the introduction and to Senator Carr for launching the book in such style. I want to ask Louise Adler, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Melbourne University Publishing, to introduce Stuart. We're delighted from the Academy's point of view that this is a venture in which we have a part, but delighted that MUP is the publisher of this important book. Thank you.
We want to keep the Minister educated, informed and entertained, so a small gift was just handed over then. Please forgive me. Thank you, Professor McGaw, and I'd like to add my welcome to Minister Carr for taking the time out of a very busy schedule to be here for this launch tonight. Minister Carr's support for research, innovation and the future well-being of the Australian book industry is on the record, but those of us who work across those sectors don't take Minister Carr's support for granted or this government's support, and we applaud him for his commitment. Thank you, Minister Carr. Distinguished guests, we might have a round of applause. Distinguished guests, Professor Stuart McIntyre, Professor Keith Hancock, distinguished guests, and maybe one day citizens. We're here to celebrate and to launch Stuart McIntyre's most recent book. He's, of course, the author of The Poor Relation. But over the past 7 years, he's also been a steadfast advocate of MUP's activities, an active and enthusiastic board member. He's provided, and here's that phrase again that Minister Carr used, wise counsel, and been a loyal friend to me personally and professionally for many years now. So I hold him in high esteem and I'm very grateful. I'm not sure, I can't see Martha here, I'm not sure whether Martha McIntyre shares the sense of gratitude that I have to him, because I have been known to ring him late at night, early in the morning, and Martha has had to hand over the telephone. So if she's on her way, I'll thank her in person later. But what I have really valued most highly over the years has been Stuart's intellectual generosity, his own prodigious work ethic, and his willingness to engage with the research of his colleagues, from fellow eminences in the field to early career researchers. In my dealings with the Academy, I've sometimes found it useful to bear in mind the insights of President Jed Bartlett. Some of you may remember President Jed Bartlett of the television series The West Wing. Minister Carr may well have some sympathies for Bartlett's views given recent events. He once observed that politics is a dog-eat-dog world, but in the Academy it's the other way round. Stuart Marr here, hollow laughter, the racking hollow laughter here. But Stuart McIntyre's collegiality, intellectual breadth and willingness to engage with the history of ideas suggests a really important and an alternative role for the modern academic, for which I know many of us here today are immensely grateful. So when Stuart called me to discuss this project, A History of the Social Sciences in Australia, I did find myself asking him what I realised was a very silly question, why he'd taken on the task when he had so many other projects requiring his attention. And then I remember that in my very first year at MUP, Stuart delivered The History Wars, A Short History of the University of Melbourne, and assisted Dick Selleck with The Shop, and I can't even think of how many other articles he produced in the same time. As everyone who's gathered here tonight knows, Stuart's research has often been groundbreaking, but he's also found time to be an active member of the Academy of the Humanities and the Academy of the Social Sciences, to mentor too many PhD students to list, to produce one award-winning history after another, and to participate in innumerable public debates, forums and committees on the teaching of history. Time is too short here for me to actually record or recite Stuart's publication list. I looked them up and I got tired and I was only at 2002. So far too long, but very impressive. MEP is proud to be Stuart McIntyre's publisher. I have to really put in parenthesis, one of Stuart McIntyre's publishers, but we view ourselves as his preeminent publisher. We're proud to be publishing his history of the social sciences and to be collaborating with the Academy in ensuring this history is made public. Please join me in welcoming Professor Stuart McIntyre to the microphone.
Thank you very much, Louise. That's very generous, too generous. And I want to thank particularly the Minister for, I'm not quite sure whether it's a matter of national security, but the Minister who'd agreed to launch this book very generously then discovered he has to fly to Queensland later this evening. And I think you have to leave about 7, don't you, Kim? And I know if I were doing that, I would not have attended a book launch at 6, and it's very generous of you. The Minister is, of course, an accredited social scientist, and to show that he's impartial, he frequently uses the word science in its Germanic meaning of encompassing the humanities and social sciences. But I know from my own experience that he has been, as a minister, determined to play the humanities and social sciences into research policy in a number of ways. And I've experienced some of those, and I particularly thank him. I should also just thank Melbourne University Publishing for all the assistance they gave, the university for its generosity in supporting this lecture. This is a travelling lecture, and I'm going to repeat it. This is a sort of a trial tonight in Brisbane and Hobart, and I'm looking forward to doing that with the assistance of the Academy. I'm particularly pleased that, I'm sure she'll forgive me for saying so, Jennifer Furnance, who's the finance officer of the Academy, has come down from Canberra for this occasion. And Jennifer has always had a keen, whenever I've been up there using the archives, she's always wanted to know what I'm doing and what I'm finding. And thank you for your assistance. And the other person who I should single out is Nikki Henningham, who has been assisting with the research over a long period of time. And I'm very grateful to her. Okay, let me see. Oh, the other thing I should say is that I prepared this lecture and prepared some overheads while I was in Britain, because I only got back a few days ago. And to my horror, when I opened it up, I discovered I hadn't sent all the overheads. I'm going to be using some data. I might omit some of it or try to summarise it, because there are a couple of slides that we're going to put it up that we're going to help do so. Faced by an intractable budgetary crisis, Louis XVI of France bowed to necessity in 1788, and he summoned the Estates General. Since this was to be the first meeting of that National Assembly in a century and a half, his finance minister invited suggestions how the three estates of the Ancien Régime, the clergy, nobility and commons, should be organised for the occasion. Emmanuel Joseph de Sierre, a priest who'd been infected by the rationalism of the Enlightenment, seized the opportunity to publish a pamphlet with the uncompromising title Qu'est-ce que le troisième état? What is the third estate, he asked? Everything. What has it been hitherto in the political order? Nothing. What does it desire to be something? The question, what are the social sciences, invites a similar response. The natural sciences, well endowed, conscious of their lineage and dignity, unquestionably comprise the temporal nobility. The humanities, esteemed for their less worldly vocation and pastoral role, might be seen as the spiritual estate, albeit reduced to mendicant status. The social sciences, at once more numerous and more disparate, constitute the third estate. Within its ranks are professional disciplines such as education and law, prominent guilds such as economics and psychology, artisanal trades such as anthropology and sociology, geography, political science. Some of the more entrepreneurial social sciences have spun off lucrative subsidiaries such as business studies and public administration. Others have contributed to new fields of interest, such as gender, environmental, indigenous and development studies. Both durable and protean, the social sciences enter into many other areas of teaching research, although their contribution is seldom fully recognised. In statements of national innovation policy and arrangements made to support it, the social sciences are nothing, and yet for 60 years they've aspired to be something. So my purpose tonight is to explore the neglect. I'm interested in the persistent stasis of the social sciences, the poor relation of our knowledge system. As Kim's pointed out, I might be overemphasising their underdog status, but certainly that's the way they feel about themselves. How was it that their claims for recognition and support were unavailing? What was their place in the Australian university as it grew to meet new expectations of higher education over the past 60 years? Was it by design or inadvertence that they are marginalised as universities acquired a research function? Or should we look instead, as I shall towards the end of the lecture, should we look instead to the failure of the social sciences to persuade decision-makers of their values? In seeking answers to these questions, I'll draw on the history of higher education and research policy. This is a neglected subject, particularly neglected in this country, and I suspect my interest in it is greater than yours, although Dick Selleck knows more about it than I do. So I'll just have to convince you, I think, of its far-reaching significance. The Australian history stretches from the Murray and Martin reports of the 1950s and 60s in an era of expansive confidence when education was a public good and our universities were nation-building institutions. The history takes in the green and white papers of John Dawkins that bent the universities to new purposes and constrained them within a national unified system. It extends to a plethora of reviews and initiatives over the past 20 years, whose substance and quality has been of inverse proportion to their frequency. And the paradoxical effect, I'd suggest, has been to insist that the university must take charge of its fortunes and to impose forms of organisation, management and accountability that prevent it from doing so. Research policy similarly seeks returns on investment in science and technology that are seldom realised but invariably generate still grander schemes. And the pleas and remonstrances of social scientists play very little part in the dialogue between government, universities and the research community. So the final purpose of my lecture will be to suggest how they might be better served. I'll begin by providing some indices for the growth of the social sciences. Back in 1939, there were just six universities in this country with a total enrolment of 14,000 students. Wartime measures and the Commonwealth Reconstruction Training Scheme after the war doubled student numbers, and the increase in academic staff was even greater. By my count, there were 452 appointments in the social sciences by 1949. I've taken that from a series of university listings in that source down there. You will see in that list that the predominance of what I call the vocational social sciences is marked. It's overstated in the figures shown there by the heavy reliance of faculties of economics and commerce and law and education on professional practitioners holding part-time appointments. Even so, economics clearly led the field. Psychology, which had only recently separated from philosophy in this country, was growing rapidly. History and philosophy, both established disciplines, enjoyed an advantage over the newcomers, political science and geography. Anthropology at this time was confined to Sydney, and sociology was absent and would remain absent for at least another decade. Even in those figures, I think some formative patterns are evident. The Australian university had begun as a device for liberal higher education, and then it added professional courses and decided to locate them in separate faculties. Except at the new Australian National University, where two of the four original research schools brought social scientists together, the post-war expansion built on existing organisational lines in keeping with its predominantly teaching function. So education and law were taught as separate and largely self-sufficient courses with a strong practical orientation. Economics created a more academic curriculum, leading to the establishment of a fourth honours year, and arts faculties followed a similar path, with new appointments allowing greater specialisation, extension into new areas of teaching and research, and the development of honours programmes that fed postgraduate research activity. Because the disciplinary department was confirmed as the organisational unit, the established disciplines were able to inhibit the introduction of new ones, and the distinctive character of each discipline became more pronounced as it filled out its offerings. Fast forward then another decade to 1959, when the bounty of the Murray Report was becoming evident. The Murray Report, some of you will know about it, arose when the Vice-Chancellor's press Robert Menzies, and he appointed a committee in 1956 to investigate how best the universities may serve Australia at a time of great social and economic development. He arranged for Keith Murray, who was the chairman of the University Grants Committee in the United Kingdom, to lead the review, and it led to the establishment of a similar body here, the Australian Universities Commission, as the Commonwealth assumed financial responsibility for Australian universities. Menzies also appointed the chair of the CSIRO, Ian Clunies Ross, as a member of the committee, because science and industry were uppermost in the government's concern, as they are indeed uppermost in the report of the Murray Committee. And the Murray Committee completed its report just as the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1, a conjunction so fortuitous that some said at the time the vice-chancellors had arranged it. Keith Murray and Ian Clunies Ross were scientists committed to a particular kind of university. The teaching, they said, in terms that are redolent of the 1950s, should provide not merely a technical and specialist training, but a full and true education befitting a free man and citizen of a free country. They did in their report acknowledge women. There was a strong emphasis there on the need to increase participation for a number of reasons. In discussing their research, they said it was important that it not be dictated by industrial concerns, because they said the exploitation of discoveries was best left to separate institutes of technology, and universities should concentrate on basic research, and indeed they should determine the balance between what their report described as the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake and research that they described as indispensable to the welfare of the nation. The Murray Report set in train a flurry of new universities after the Sydney Technical College had become the University of New South Wales, or initially a technological university and then a university in the wider sense, and the University College of New England achieved autonomy in 1954. We get the creation of Monash in 1958, the lifting of the Canberra University College to university status as part of the ANU in 1960, creation of Newcastle as a university in 1961, new university colleges at Townsville 1961, Wollongong 1962, and preparations already underway for Macquarie and La Trobe, both established formally in 1964, and Flinders 1966. Now those last three, Macquarie, La Trobe and Flinders, were the most adventurous. The others very largely replicated existing universities, but these concentrated on general studies in the social sciences, humanities and sciences. They taught very few professional courses. They rejected the disciplinary department as the unit of organisation in favour of schools that could span disciplinary boundaries. And the rationale of the social science degree designed at Flinders by the young economist, Keith Hancock, that they recognised the complexity and interdependence of human affairs, could be taken as a description, I think, of the objectives of those three universities. And for reasons that I don't have time to explore here, that, I think, generous undertaking of a university education, a new sort of university education, did not survive in the long term. A second Commonwealth inquiry, 5 years later, this one conducted by the Melbourne physicist Leslie Martin, confirmed a binary divide between universities and other bodies of tertiary education. Universities would combine teaching and research in academic disciplines. The others would combine teaching, would be teaching applied and vocational courses. Now, perhaps paradoxically, the social sciences benefited disproportionately from this rapid expansion of the university system. By 1969, they were teaching approximately 40% of the 108,000 university enrolments in Australia. And this is where I wanted to throw up my slide. Perhaps if I go back to the earlier one, I can at least. The figures for academic staff in 1969 were economics 556, law 169, education 132, and then some quite noticeable growth. History 291, psychology 203, political science 149, philosophy 132, geography 120, anthropology 59, and sociology by 1969 had 47 academic posts. Those figures, I think, reveal that the principal beneficiaries of this growth were the social science departments in arts faculty, for a number of reasons. They were more active in research, they enjoyed much better staff-student ratios than the professional faculties, and they flourished in this period. They and the universities would benefit further from the largesse of the Whitlam government and then feel the effects of the sharp downturn that followed the OPEC oil crisis of 1973-74. So that, and here I wish I had a slide, from education, from all educational expenditure as a percentage of gross national product amounting to 1.62% in 1950-51, it had risen to 3.15% in 1960-61 and 4.62% in 1970-71 to reach a peak of 6.46% in 1976-77. Hangover, Fraser wanted to cut it but couldn't. And at that time, the government contribution to education was 6.13%. Now, that level has never since been regained. The universities were becalmed after 30 years of favourable conditions, and I think they took some time to realise that this wasn't a temporary misfortune. I can see that some of you were in universities at that time, and in the late 1970s we thought this was an abnormal, just wait a while and they'll see sense. Drifting, I think the universities waited for trade winds to refill their sails, and of course they waited in vain as the Fraser government failed to find a way out of the economic doldrums. In 1985 values, the Commonwealth provided the universities in 1975 with $1,335 million, and in 1985 it was $1,374 million, as in the decade in the late 90s and first part of the present decade, they were essentially becalmed. And as a proportion of gross national product, expenditure on higher education fell between 1975 and 85 from 1.5 to 1%. Now that brings me to the second function of the modern university, research. At the beginning of this history, that was more of an aspiration than a regular practice. The private sector spent very little on research and development. It derived much of its technology from overseas, while government at this time directed its effort to separate agencies such as the CSIRO. Urged on by some influential social scientists in the public service, to whom I'll return, Ben Chifley was persuaded that Australia needed its own capacity for research and research training. And it was decided that it would be provided by a special Institute of Advanced Studies in the nation's capital that would be free of all teaching responsibilities and would have a separate budgetary appropriation. As you might expect, Melbourne, Sydney and the other established universities refused to accept this division of labour. When they created their own PhD degrees. But throughout the 1950s, they relied for their research endeavours on internal economies. It was after the Murray Report that the Commonwealth grant included, to universities included a component to support research, but it wasn't until Leslie Martin completed his inquiry in 1964 that the Australian Research Grants Committee was established, the precursor of the ARC, and for the first time there was an external source of research support. In its first 3 years in the late 1960s, the ARGC distributed $9.5 million to academic researchers. Those in the social sciences submitted 16% of applications and were awarded 15% of grants. We've done a lot better than that now. And it was worth 9% of the funding. And since the other source of research support was, of course, the National Health and Medical Research Council and it had a similar budget, you can see that the proportion of national competitive grant income directed to the social sciences was less than 5%. Now, that's an incomplete measure of research activity at the time. In the late 1960s, higher degree candidates in the social sciences made up nearly 20% of all candidates, and expenditure on social science research amounted to a little over 10% of all university research expenditure. But from the very outset, the machinery for public support of university research was dominated by natural scientists. The first chair of the ARGC was in fact a president of the Academy of Science. The head of the department that administered it was a former treasurer of the same academy. And the department with which it was contained, a new one, was designated the Department of Education and Science. Australia wasn't alone in that orientation. It was in the post-war period that science acquired an aura of unrivalled authority. Its claims were set out most compellingly by Vannevar Bush, a New England electrical engineer who was the architect of wartime science in the United States. And in 1945, he submitted a report to President Truman on post-war arrangements entitled Science, the Endless Frontier. And the nub of Bush's argument was that the major advances made recently in aeronautics, electronics, synthetic materials, pharmaceuticals, and above all, nuclear fission, had all come from discoveries in the purest realms of science. And Bush concluded that the best way of organising research was to encourage what he called the free play of free intellects working on subjects of their own choice in the manner dictated by their curiosity. Now, that was the policy that guided the National Science Foundation in the United States and similar funding bodies elsewhere, including the AIGC, until the 1970s, when faltering economic performance cast doubt on its efficacy as well as its growing expense. And at that time, it seemed that the leading industrial economies were falling behind new competitors, notably Japan, where government directed research effort towards specific industries and products and drove technological innovation at the industry and enterprise level. And along with other member countries of the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, Australia looked to similar arrangements. It took its guidance from changes introduced overseas and established a body called the Australian Science and Technology Council, or ASTEC, to coordinate activity. In a series of reports and reviews in the late 1970s and early 1980s, ASTEC set out plans whereby research would be linked to commercial development and technological innovation, would create new industries to restore economic growth. And in universities, where most of the basic research was conducted, it said there should be a concentration of effort through the identification of priorities and greater involvement of end users. Now, all of these reports by ASTEC, all of its advice, I think took research as synonymous with scientific innovation and development as its translation into new products. From time to time, ASTEC would pay lip service to basic research in the social sciences and humanities, but without any acknowledgement that they might work with different paradigms. And ASTEC's strategy, moreover, was premised on a greater business investment in research and development, as indeed was occurring in countries where growth resumed in the 1980s, but did not occur here. In Australia, where the government remained the patron of academic research, efforts to consummate those sorts of industrial partnerships went largely unrequited. From the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s, in short, the Australian university was at a standstill, and then John Dawkins broke the deadlock. With his abolition of the binary divide in 1988 came an expansion of student numbers, a much greater emphasis on work skills and a proliferation of vocational courses. Through the introduction of deferred tuition charges, an invention of a fellow of the academy, and through full fees for international students, the government freed itself of the cost constraints of increased participation. By encouraging mergers, it created larger and more entrepreneurial institutions. By forcing changes to university government and imposing a new regimen of efficiency and accountability, it replaced collegial decision-making with a corporate style of management. And that, in essence, is how Australia made the transition from the elite university to the mass system of higher education. Introducing the changes, if you look at the white paper, Dawkins said that there had to be a greater concentration on science, engineering, and technology, and yet the effect was to increase the social sciences to over 50% of enrolments by the 1990s. A further effect was to shift from disciplinary departments and faculties for the scale and flexibility of multidisciplinary schools and divisions. This was encouraged at a time when funding per student was falling steadily. Effective full-time enrolments in social sciences rose from 150,000 in 1988, when the unified national system began, to 220,000 in 1996, but staff numbers barely increased from 8,900 to, sorry about the spacing there, from 8,900 to 9,400. Incidentally, by this time, higher education statistics no longer distinguish disciplines, but you can see there that education suffered very significant attrition after the merger of the colleges with the faculties of education, that social sciences in arts faculties experience modest growth, but a very sharp deterioration of staff-student ratios. And the conglomerate of business studies and law expanded significantly. Within those portmanteau categories, moreover, there was an expansion of applied studies at the expense of core disciplines, and one that's continued ever since. By 2007, there would be five times as many students enrolled in business and management studies as in economics. Now, the changes to academic research were less dramatic. They were more of an amplification, I think, of earlier trends. Dawkins' Green Paper said that research should restore economic competitiveness, but that had been said many times before. He turned the Research Grants Committee into a research council, the ARC, and he augmented its budget with a clawback from the research component of the university's block funding, but that was only an adjustment of Australia's system of dual funding. He increased provision for research centres, he promulgated research priorities, he required universities to do the same. Most of you can probably recall attempts to state research priorities in your institution, and they had very limited effect. Indeed, the creation of a unified national system in which all universities were eligible to conduct research and undertake research training across the full range of their academic activity contradicted Dawkins' avowed intention of concentrating effort. And the increase in the ARC's budget was outstripped by the increase in applications. The success rate dropped well below 20% in the early 1990s. The social science share of ARC funding at this time ranged between 11 and 16%, but the ARC was upstaged by now by, as a source of advice to government by a new body, the Prime Minister's Science Council. It's undergone subsequent changes of name. And it was the Prime Minister's Science Council and the Chief Scientist who devised, for instance, the new scheme of cooperative research centres from which the humanities and social sciences were excluded until Kim Carr reversed the exclusion a couple of years ago. Now, the more recent history, I think, is probably too fresh to you to require retelling. In higher education, the Howard government increased the operation of the market, contained fiscal costs, cost to its own budget, increased student charges, wrung all possible benefit out of the international student revenue, with increasing strains that the recent Bradley Review documented. In research, it did little more than recalibrate the funding formulas until the turn of the century, when the program called Backing Australia's Ability injected a large additional sum for science and technology. And I think it was there, at any point if you wanted to nominate it, it was there when the then chief scientist determined a separate provision for science and the application of four extraordinarily circumscribed research priorities to the ARC's support of basic research, that the status of the social sciences, a poor relation, was formalised. Australia is not alone in privileging big science as the engine of innovation, nor in the belief, despite all evidence to the contrary, that you can identify frontier technologies, assemble large research teams in expensive facilities, manage their progress and commercialise their discoveries. If you read the innovation documents of most OECD countries, they all express that belief. Australia differs, I think, primarily in its reliance on a single funding body as the only source of funding for basic research. That is, with the exception of medical research, we lack both the private foundations that support such work in the United States and the range of funding bodies that operate in Europe. So there's an increasing quantity of commissioned, applied and developmental work, but it bears an inverse relationship in the social sciences to basic research. Let me just give you one statistic. In commerce, management, tourism and services, they are the largest field of university research and development, with an expenditure in 2004, the figure is from, of $193 million. But in that year, they attracted just $3.8 million in discovery grants. The mismatch of piecemeal task work and core knowledge had become acute. Why are the social sciences so regularly excluded from Australian research policy? Well, back in the 1940s, there had been an effort to give the social sciences recognition. It was instigated by a group of academics who'd been drawn into wartime administration in order to guide the planning and management of the war effort. And they were supported by a group of economists occupying senior government posts, I think particularly of Nugget Coombs, Douglas Copeland, John Crawford, Ronald Walker and Roland Wilson. And the idea that they came to together was that social scientists would assist government in its ambitious tasks of post-war reconstruction by undertaking research on a wide range of matters of national concern. So a new organisation, which they called the Social Science Research Council, could act as a source of advice and indeed could allocate government funds to academic researchers to pursue these projects. That proposal, which was developed in 1943 and 44, failed for a variety of reasons. Two I'd single out: the reluctance of government to fund such an arrangement and the fierce opposition of the vice-chancellors to anyone coming between them and the public purse. Probably the latter reason was more important. So it took a very generous grant from the Carnegie Corporation of the United States to prize a matching amount from the Commonwealth for an attenuated Social Science Research Council to continue its existence. And through the 1950s and 60s, the Social Science Research Council used those funds to undertake a number of foundational activities that I describe in the book. I think they're foundational because they helped to constitute the social sciences research disciplines, so that the money was used to compile bibliographies, to assist the establishment of academic journals, to subsidise monographs, organise seminars in new fields, and provide research and travel grants, and also to foster relations with international counterparts through international disciplinary associations. And subsequently, the SSRC raised additional funds for some major projects. The first was on women in Australia. The second on improvements to the income tax system, the third on circumstances of Aboriginal Australians, and then one on migrants, and one in the 1970s, an environmental study of Botany Bay. Several of those projects, especially the Aboriginal and migrant ones, had very substantial consequences for public policy. I don't think it's exaggerating to say that they laid intellectual foundations for Aboriginal self-determination and multiculturalism. Although in both cases, the investigations aroused official suspicion. Commonwealth continued to support the SSRC, but always at a lower level than the grant it provided to the Academy of Science. The government wasn't terribly impressed when the Social Science Research Council turned itself into an academy, the Academy of the Social Sciences, in 1971. I think to government, that seemed to confirm its academic orientation. And for that matter, the Academy was no more effective in its advocacy than the Social Science Research Council had been. It often grumbled about the neglect of social sciences in higher education, but it found great difficulty in presenting persuasive alternatives. I would suggest that there was a mutual misunderstanding that persisted through these post-war decades. That is, social scientists repeatedly claimed that they could improve policy if only they were given the means to apply their insights. For its part, government repeatedly found the advice it received to be ill-informed and impractical. And it also noted that most of the money it provided for social science research in universities was going into intramural activity. That is, every branch of social science seemed to need its own professional association and journal, its own disciplinary infrastructure, its own conferences and so on. And the claim that these academic entrepreneurs could serve practical purposes seemed in Canberra to be a thin disguise for their empire building. I think also that the problem was exacerbated by the failure of social scientists to distinguish their forms of knowledge from those of the natural scientists. The social sciences, as I've suggested, were configured in this country as separate disciplines and in an organisational structure that restricted opportunities for interaction. And by the time the social sciences had been established here, earlier attempts both in North America and Europe to build a unifying epistemology for the study of society had very largely collapsed. The social sciences, it seemed to me, operated at a further disadvantage. If scientists work with broadly accepted methods of explanation applicable across the natural world, then social scientists dealt very largely with human activity in time and place. They invoked the authority of science to distinguish their knowledge from popular understandings used in everyday life, and they laid claim to an exclusive expertise that qualified them to undertake specialised and systematic inquiry. But much of what these socialist scientists did and found remained obstinately vulnerable to popular judgments of its validity and utility. Social science, in short, lacked the powerful mystique attached to natural science, at least, I suppose, until the recent efforts to discredit climate change. Few people would challenge the claims of scientists in the way that they did social scientists. Besides, as it was pointed out, social scientists seemed to make no transformative discoveries. They didn't invent breakthrough technologies. They were served even more poorly by the new research paradigm that took hold in the 1980s. From this time, the object of government was to capture the intellectual creativity of academic researchers, to take knowledge production out of the hands of self-directed disciplinary groups, and put it at the disposal of business and government. And at first, this involved schemes of exhortation and encouragement, but when that failed, there was increasing recourse to prescription. Initially, universities were offered incentives to cooperate, but then came the batteries of accountability and evaluation and audit that turned them into knowledge managers. Successive reviews, and there were many of them in the 1980s and 1990s, drew attention to the disappointing results of such policies, and the solution that was invariably proposed was to go further. If Australia lagged in innovation and universities were failing to serve it, then universities had to be pressed harder. If academics persisted in their hermetic attachment to disciplines, then they needed to be assembled in larger multidisciplinary teams following designated tasks. If too many of them were producing work of little merit or significance, then evaluation should lead to greater concentration activity. And the constant search, I think, for improvement found expression in increasing elaborate schemes for the management of research, but no one ever questioned the efficacy of research management. This new paradigm, I think, has particular significance for the social sciences. From the early advice of ASTEC, the Science and Technology Council, to the recent provision for super science, social scientists are normally expected to follow arrangements devised by scientists for science. The circumstances of big science, that is, advanced technologies that generate rapid discovery, allow a concentration of effort in large-scale institutes and centres, with management systems designed to facilitate interaction with government and industry and to produce outcomes that can be commercialised as intellectual property, those features do not apply to social science or to most social science research. One of our disadvantages, I'd suggest, please the Minister's here to hear it, is that we don't cost enough. Our requests look pitifully small. Our business propositions look overly modest. Nor is there a congruence of methods. Scientists work cumulatively in paradigms that are relatively stable and with experimental procedures that allow, give or take climate change, for consensus. Whereas social scientists work in a multiplicity of directions. Some are qualitative, some quantitative, some experimental or ethnographic or what have you. The disciplines in the social sciences overlap and contest each other, but they very seldom resolve their differences. That is, they conduct border raids and plunders each other's attractive ideas. They provide alternative perspectives. It has been suggested that economics and sociology correct each other's absurdities. But it doesn't have great effect on their separate practices. And that lack of agreement is frequently taken as a sign of backwardness and an impediment to the interdisciplinary collaboration that's enshrined in research policy. Now, it's not for want of trying that the disciplines haven't converged. The Social Science Research Council of the United States began, in fact, in the 1920s, with the intention of bringing them together, and it failed to do so. The principal American foundation sponsored very large-scale endeavours of the same sort after the Second World War, again with disappointing results. There are many examples of collaborative research on social problems, but problems, I'd suggest, have a shorter life cycle and don't usually create the same enduring, self-reproducing research communities. And given the institutional incentives for interdisciplinary research, the failure to integrate social science disciplines suggests that something other than obstinacy is at work. Those who manage research regard disciplines as often as obstacles to collaboration. A very lazy metaphor describes them as silos, disregarding the function of the silo as a facility that stores grain and protects it from predators. Disciplines are often seen as constraints on creativity. They're artificial barriers or congeries of self-interest. I would argue strongly that they are, on the contrary, powerfully durable ways of organising and advancing knowledge, and that the social science disciplines provide models of society, each one of them with its own conceptual map that defines what it's possible to know and how it might be known. And it's the partial and specialised character of these disciplines that gives them their force and coherence, indeed constitutes them as disciplined forms of inquiry. And it also means that interdisciplinary collaboration in the social sciences is much more than a pooling of knowledge or expertise. It's made possible and fruitful by conscious exploration of the grounds of that knowledge. Social science research resists the rapid discoveries that characterise the sciences with their advanced research technologies.
Social scientists very frequently use computers to store and analyse large bodies of data, for instance, but first of all they have to collect it. And the subjects of their research are people who are self-reflective and self-interpreting, as indeed are the researchers. They might provide explanations, but their capacity to predict is limited. Have the economists, excuse me, and I say that if economists could do so with certainty, then the stock exchange would be a sure bet, indeed it'd be unnecessary. In short, I think that social science disciplines are best served by making their distinctive qualities clear. They need to articulate what they do, how they do it, and why it matters. For too long, I think, they've responded to their neglect in research policy with arguments couched in the terms of that policy, and their persistent claim, "We do that too," has failed to alter the imbalance. I think mimicry is both unpersuasive and demoralising, and it's better that social scientists stop imitating their rich relation and be true to themselves. By doing so, they can indeed contribute to public policy and serve national objectives with a better understanding of what they have to offer.
Advocacy, I think, is important. Advocacy is for gaining the attention of those who determine the fortunes of the Australian university. Once advocacy gets you inside the minister's office, then my concern, I think, has always been to argue for social science disciplines. And that argument begins with the extensive and detailed knowledge that Australia needs to conduct its own affairs and to deal with other countries. And the disciplines are repositories of that specialist knowledge, and they provide the modes of investigation and bridges to work done elsewhere. We run them down at our peril. Disciplines are complex organisms, I think, that draw their sustenance from a combination of method and content, and their maintenance requires a rich undergraduate major and a full honours program and broad opportunities for research training. Thin out the branches of a discipline so that, for instance, in philosophy you concentrate on applied ethics and no longer offer logic or metaphysics. Reduce the options so that in history you teach the modern world but not earlier periods. Tailor the curriculum to applied studies so that anthropologists are too busy with development studies to cover kinship or social structure. And strip out the more speculative components so that policy studies displace political theory. Thin out the branches of a discipline in that way, and the discipline withers and loses its capacity to interact with other disciplines. To conclude then, if social science disciplines are to be sustained, I think there needs to be attention to their configuration. If their potential is to be realised and brought to bear on important tasks of social inquiry and social criticism, they need to be freed from the straitjacket of current research policy. The social sciences have been treated over a long period as the poor relation of the research enterprise, been treated that way for so long, I think, that in many cases they've come to accept their lowly status. They need to claim their inheritance. Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart. I'll thank you more fully at the end, but this is a period for questions for those of you who'd like to...
Or disagreements.
Well, questions or comments then. Over to you. Yes, Stuart.
Hans and then Sue.
Oh, there's a microphone coming.
Right. One behind you.
Yeah, it seems that we now have the corporate university. And I guess as an anthropologist and a social scientist, I've often wondered whether one of the reasons that the social sciences are sort of the poor relation here is that they're not so directly involved in the corporate or the profit-making endeavor. So what are your thoughts along those lines?
Well, I suppose I've implicit in what I've been saying is that, of course, they are. That if you look to see in economics as well as in business and management studies, you find things that are quite interesting. One of the problems, I think, about innovation theory as it's understood and applied in research policy is that it is highly technological in nature. We know that most improvements in efficiency and productivity don't come from technological breakthroughs. They come from improvements in other ways in the productive process, which are the domain of social scientists. So I think there's a paradox in that, for various reasons, there is a rather credulous belief in a technological model of innovation, which leads to propositions about large investments in plant, and there's some of them Clayton and some of them here, premised on returns that are inherently very difficult to realise. The whole process of product innovation is one that I think economists advise on much better than scientists, but they're not fully involved in that process. So I could talk longer and elaborate that a little more, but I suppose my point is that the understanding we have at the moment about innovation, which informs research policy, is I think a very narrow one, which unnecessarily excludes social science.
Hello, Sue Richardson. Stuart, that was a beautiful presentation. I thought that was insightful and richly researched, and I'll meditate on many of your insights for many years to come. But as an economist, I actually don't share the fundamental message that you're giving, that, you know, social sciences are the poor relation and they can't have their voice heard. I actually think that economics actually is in danger of being too dominant. It's too, yes. You know, have occupied the commanding heights of public policy. So the notion that, you know, that economics is sort of downtrodden, I think is at odds with the experience. Now, they're not particularly well funded like the rest of the social sciences. I certainly agree with that. But in terms of not being important, and a heard voice, I think that's just wrong.
Yeah. Thank you, Sue, and thank you for your kind words, because we've discussed, you kept on asking, what am I doing in my research, and I've given you much more halting explanations on previous occasions, haven't I? This is my first time. I don't know whether we're all together at loggerheads, because I would have no doubt at all that methods of economic analysis inform public policy in a very powerful way. And we can think in many areas of social policy where essentially economic paradigms of behaviour obtain. And that's a further paradox, isn't it? Because I think there's often a disjuncture between the sort of research that economists do, the curiosity-based research, and the forms of applied economics. I mean, a striking example, so that economics is at the same time necessary, and on the other hand, as you suggested, it's underfunded in its research. It's eclipsed in many universities by forms of applied economics at the expense of pure economics, which is where real discoveries are going to come. And I think there's a sort of an ambiguity in Australian attitudes. I suppose I was struck by this with the, what I might call it a debate, but the public discussion of the resource super profits tax, where there were economists queuing up to explain the benefits of adopting such approach, but they were simply swept aside. And that they were swept aside by vested interests who undoubtedly were drawing on economists in their organisations. But that the advice given, if you like, by the academic research community didn't prevail. And much the same, I think, can be said, for instance, of some of the reports, whisper this here, many of the reports, for instance, of the Productivity Commission, I think, are often have great insight. I mean, their report several years ago into publicly funded research is a document with which I'd agree with a great deal. It talked about the distinction, the problem of confusing public research and private research, and made a number of suggestions why basic research should be better supported in universities, had no effect at all. So I think there's a sort of a disjuncture of that sort that still operates. Yeah.
On the question of the resource rent tax, I think that's an extremely interesting example. But there, I think, was actually about a set of ideas up against extraordinarily powerful vested interests. Now, climate change is the same.
Yes.
Climate change, the scientific evidence for climate change is almost universally accepted by scientists.
Yes.
And yet it's got no traction, or not much traction, at a political level. And that's about the same powerful invested interest in many cases as the ones that crunched,
yes,
the resource rent tax.
I think that's true. I think that in some ways there's been a loss of intellectual authority by the research community. If you think back to the 1940s and 50s and the powerful credibility that people had, I do think that the climate change thing is significant because for the first time, I was suggesting that many people regard social science research as either unnecessary, trivial, or you know, why do it, but have always been very respectful of science, partly because they found it harder to understand. And the chief significance for me of the debate over climate change, I don't know whether you, at the National Academies Forum, where the presidents of the Academy of Science and Technological Sciences and Engineering were saying this is terrible and we have to take a stand, and how dare they launch ad hominem attacks on scientists in this way. And I had to say, with my History Wars scars still fresh, I said, welcome to the club. Because they're drawn into exactly that sort of public rhetoric or media rhetoric.
Stuart, you would have seen at Harvard the benefits of general education for undergraduates, and I think we see here with the Melbourne model an attempt to broaden education. So we're looking at a T-shaped education, which you've got presumably depth within the discipline which you're advocating, as well as breadth which goes across many disciplines. And I think one of the aspects of one factor which I think contributes to what I don't see as poor relation but rather forgotten relation is that social scientists don't really sit together with natural scientists in classrooms doing the same subjects. And as long as that happens, and you know, I observe it in CSIRO, that it's not that they think we're poor. I think they just don't think we're awfully relevant because they haven't really interacted with us. And I think it goes the other way, that we don't really understand all that much about the natural sciences. So I think a way forward is really what kind of education we provide so that not only do we get that knowledge which enables the cultures to actually break down the boundaries, but the people who become the policy makers, the opinion leaders, the powerful people within government, industry, etc., are people who have sat side by side with students from the social sciences. And I think until that happens, we'll be somewhat overlooked and forgotten.
So I think I'm reluctant to get into the discussion of the Melbourne model because John Dewar will have rights of reply and then Ari Freiberg will want to. But I would distinguish the Melbourne model's curriculum from that given at Harvard, which offers a very rich variety of disciplines in depth, which is not being offered under the Melbourne model. There's a thinning out of core disciplines to an alarming degree under the Melbourne model, but that's partly due to factors that don't necessarily are not inherent in the idea of a general degree first. Yes, I agree with you. I think that, is there a misunderstanding between scientists and social scientists? Well, my book tells a story, I think, where for a long period of time, scientists were deliberately intending to exclude social scientists. Mark Oliphant, I think, will get the Academy Award for this. He thought that social science was bogus and that he would have no time for it. And that's less the case now. In many, I think, of the most interesting areas of contemporary research, the distinction between the physical and the social breaks down, doesn't it? And I would certainly agree with you, this is Barry's territory rather than mine, that Australia has suffered, I think, in its school education from premature specialisation to an alarming degree. Most of us who went through school had to choose between humanities and science from year 11, didn't we? And I think in university we're simply continuing that in the way in which the organisational streaming occurred. So yes, I'd agree with you about that.
Thank you. Well, Lynn, we'll take one more and then we'll go and have a drink together and you can talk to Stuart further at that point. But go ahead.
Stuart, I'm wondering, I'm very in sympathy with a lot of the things that you've been saying about some of the different forms of the social sciences. It seems to me that both in government policy and in university and research management circles that some of the issues are not simply to do with the past preferences for science or science being more mysterious, but the extent to which in the way management is thought about and the need to have everything go through a common template.
Yes.
And that seems to have been strengthening, and I'm just wondering whether you've got any sense of hope of different directions.
Minister accused me of being too despondent. All I'd say, I think, about... Yes, you're undoubtedly right, and it operates at a number of... Well, it operates in Australia very powerfully in the funding model that was developed in the 1980s and 90s, which, you know, Commonwealth officials would keep on saying, we're not telling universities they have to use the national formula in their own internal allocations, knowing full well they would. And I think that was quite ruinous to a number of important disciplines. And yes, there are a number of other ways in which common templates are imposed. I don't think that's a purely Australian phenomenon. It's apparent in most countries that are trying to develop mass systems of higher education. And I agree with you, well, this is more your area than mine, I think that it has major intellectual flaws. I think it is very difficult to... There is a great difficulty, I think, in remaining true to an educational objective when you have sort of input-output models of education.
Thank you very much, Stuart. Before we conclude, I'd like to give Keith Hancock a chance to make a comment.
Since the Academy had been generous enough to honour me by having this lecture named after me, I just want to say that I really am honoured by the quality of the lecture that we heard tonight, and also the associated book, which I have read from cover to cover. I think they're both sources of enormous stimulation. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Keith. And as you heard earlier, you can hear it again in Brisbane and Hobart, if you wish. Can I, on behalf of all of us, thank you, Stuart, very much for the stimulation of the lecture and the whetting of the appetite for those who have not yet seen the whole book for the more detailed ideas that are expressed there. It's a great piece of work. It started out as a reflection on where we've come from as an academy. It's turned into a history of the social sciences that's a tour de force, really. So thank you very much. And can I invite you to join us, Stuart and others, for drinks outside. Thank you.